Richard Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique. Never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Wednesday, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. I am very excited about today's show because I get to sit down and chat with someone that I think of almost as an old friend, Stanley Livingston, who we all know as Chip from My Three Sons. I have said on more than one occasion that I am a product of 1960s and 70s television, but I remember my grandparents, Emery and Getha Wallace Skipper, my dad's parents, getting their first color television set. And we would go to their house on Thursday nights and we would all sit around and we would watch My Three Sons. Stanley, first of all, I want to thank you so much for being here today. And before we delve into your past, I want to really look at where you are today. We are still, unfortunately, in the middle of a pandemic. And I want to know how you're doing, really, in the midst of this crazy world we're in.
Well, I'm doing like everybody else, just holding up, you know. It's definitely a different life these days, you know, not seeing your friends, not seeing your family. And I think, like all of us, can't wait till it's over. I got my first COVID shot.
Good for you.
Next one in a week. So I guess that'll afford me some protection.
And what did your calendar look like? Today marks 349 days. It's hard to believe since our theaters, I'm in New York, since our theater shut down here. And of course, it's had a trickle-down effect across the country. What did your calendar look like prior to everything shutting down?
It looks like just like the day I bought it at Staples. There's nothing on it. I might have unwrapped it.
You know, have you been able to adapt to this? I mean, life. I mean, so many people have become very creative, finding other areas to be creative in their own homes. Are you one of those people, or have you resisted everything?
Yeah, no. I've got plenty. I've always been a project-oriented person. So if I'm not working on a film or TV project, then I've got my projects at home. I'm a do-it-yourselfer kind of guy. I'm like, what was his name? Tim Allen on Home Improvement. That's me. So our house is always under various stages of hammering, sawing, nailing, putting pipes in, electrical work. I kind of like doing that.
Well, Stanley, I want to begin by you have been in our consciousness, well, my whole life. But as I was doing my research, something that really intrigued me was when you were 4 years old, you were part of a group called the Water Babies.
Correct. Yeah. my parents moved to Hollywood. I guess they were drawn by the allure of Hollywood in 1948. I came along in 1950. My mother wanted me to learn how to swim at a young age. I think there was a drowning in the family a couple of years earlier. And for whatever reason, they wanted me to know how to swim. So they sent me to a swim school in Hollywood. A lady named Jen Lovin owned and operated it. And it was pretty successful, gathered by the number of kids and teens who were at that pool every day. It kind of became a hub for celebrities to send their kids there to learn how to swim. And the lady that owned it was very entrepreneurial. She got magazines to come out and cover all these little kids diving off of high boards. And she had a hole cut in the side of the pool underwater. And it was probably about a 4-foot circle with glass in it. So you could shoot underwater pictures. So it looked amazing. So you'd see all these kids. And she'd put cars and swings and tricycles and all kinds of weird stuff underwater. And we'd ride on it. And because of that, the pool got quite a reputation, and there was a show back in that era called You Asked for It, and I'm sure she was the one who asked for it.
Of course.
So the crew came down and did a whole episode, a segment on water babies. So, you know, it was everything from infants who were just maybe a couple weeks old to, you know, children in their teens who had learned how to swim at the school. She had a high dive. regular diving board, and you know, we do triples and somersaults, dive off the high board, doing all kinds of crazy things. So yeah, you know, she got some producers and agents and directors sending their kids there, and there was an agent who saw me, and she liked the way I looked. I was extroverted and had this extra addition of a swimming skill there. So she decided, you know, she talked to my mom, and after a little coercing, she finally got my mom to agree that she could represent me, and she started sending me out on interviews. And yeah, my early work was, I went out and I was just a neighborhood kid on some shows back in the probably mid-1950s. Mm-hmm. Some of the work even uncredited. But eventually I did an episode of Ozzie and Harriet, which again, I was just hired as an extra. But in the middle of shooting, Ozzie Nelson came up to me and he said, "Hey, listen, could you say this line when you get right here?" And the backstory was, Ozzie was selling Christmas trees in his backyard to make some extra money at Christmas time. And anyway, he's got a prospective client there, and he's talking to the guy to buy a Christmas tree, and all of a sudden about 10 little kids come out with backpacks and their sleeping bags. And my line was, right when I got on the spot, was, "Sure was mighty good camping in there, Mr. Nelson." And
the rest is history.
And he shot it again as a close-up, and you know, I didn't know what it meant, but what it ended up meaning was he talked to my mother after and said, "Gee, I really like him, and can you leave your name and number with my secretary before you leave? And I want to have him come back." And yes, old Hollywood story. Everybody's going to have you come back. We'll see you again. And then they never do.
Never hear from them again.
Ozzie was a gentleman and true to his word. He had me back a couple months later, and I did another episode, then another one. And from about 1956 to 1960, I probably did 3, 4, 5 episodes for the Nelsons. And I started working, getting other TV shows, started getting movies. I was in a film with an actress named Dorothy Provine.
Yeah.
We had an early version of Bonnie and Clyde. It was called The Bonnie Parker Story. I think Roger Corman made it, if I'm not mistaken.
Sounds like one of his films.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, she was just starting off her career, as a lot of people were. And he did another movie, and it was a double bill in the movie theater and the drive-in. It was The Bonnie Parker Story with Machine Gun Kelly, which was Charles Bronson. So, anyway, yeah, you know, I started doing films and a lot of TV shows. And
well, I want to go back to your parents for a moment. You said that your parents came out to Hollywood.
Yeah.
With the allure of Hollywood. Can you tell us a little bit about your parents and where are they from originally?
Yeah, my mom was from a small town in Pittsburgh. It was called Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. If you blinked, you would have driven through it. It's about a block long. Mm-hmm. And she was raised on a farm there. And she had, I think it was 8 or 9 brothers and sisters. And when she was about 16, she said, "I've had it. I'm leaving." She took off for the big city. I guess the big city to her was Baltimore, and that's where she went. And she was kind of a wild child. And she applied and got a job at my grandfather's theater in the world of burlesque. She was a stripper. So my dad by then had been coerced to come back from New York, where he was attending NYU, to become a psychiatrist. And, you know, you heard the sob story, your dad needs help, your mom needs help, everybody's sick, come back and help. So he came back, and thank God for that, or I wouldn't be here. So he's got a load of my mom, and the rest is history. They kind of stuck it out with the theater till about 1947, and they decided they were moving to California.
So was your mom pursuing a career in the business herself out in California? Or did it come as a fluke that obviously after Water Babies that everything started falling into your lap?
Yeah, I think, you know, there was still a little streak of show business in her. And my mom, you know, she wasn't proud of what she did afterwards. It was, you know, during the war years, people needed money. That was a good way to make good money then. And she sent most of her money back to her mother in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. But she just did not want to move back to a small city and didn't, you know, it wasn't her. If you knew my mom, you'd know why. But anyway, she sort of retired from show business and goes, "I want to get the heck out of Baltimore. I don't want anybody to know me." She had a name. Her name was Marilyn Primrose. And that's the stripper name.
Great name.
Same thing with my aunt. She wanted to get out of there. She married my dad's younger brother, and all of them came to California in 1948. So I think she liked to have been in showbiz, and, you know, here this opportunity came along, and she sort of, you know, was vested in it, at least for me. So, you know, she wasn't saying no, and we tried it. And, you know, there's plenty of kids who try it, and it just doesn't work out. Either you don't have the right look, or you don't have the right personality, or, you know, whatever. And fortunately for me, it worked out real well. So
now you, of course, I mean, went into My Three Sons with Fred McMurray, who was a major star at that time. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that your mom and dad knew of the excitement of this project. Did you have any?
Well, no, they didn't.
They didn't.
No, because when My Three Sons came about, it was top secret. Nobody knew, because it was really the first time a movie star of that caliber was going to do a TV series. You know, most of the people that came to TV, their careers had maybe subsided a little bit. And here was this other opportunity in the small box in your living room called TV. But to get a guy who was at the height of his career, you know, he was just coming off The Apartment, and The Shaggy Dog, and The Absent Minded Professor. And a couple of years before that, The Caine Mutiny, and had made about 70 movies and probably was for years the top highest paid actor in Hollywood. But he had his reasons. That's how that came about. He and his wife June adopted mm-hmm. twins. And I guess he did a few movies, then realized, hey, I'm not seeing my kids grow up. I'm going away for 6 months, 8 months at a pop. And he was looking for something where he could go to work and continue in the industry and come home at night at 6 o'clock and spend time with his kids and have the weekend off and literally have most of the summer off because of the way we shot. They kind of arranged the schedule around what he wanted to do. So, when I went out for My Three Sons, which there's a little bit of a backstory to that, too. I'd done these Ozzie and Harriets and I'd probably mm-hmm. done about 5 or 6 movies by then. While I was doing Ozzie and Harriet, when I didn't have time, you know, a lot of times there's downtime, you don't have anything to do. And I was a kid and I was rambunctious and I couldn't just sit there. I go wandering around the studio and walk onto other people's sound stages and go, hi, how you doing? You know, what are you shooting here? And anyway, I did that to the sound stage next door. And anyway, it turned out there was a horse on that show and I was into animals. So I went back there with the trainer and he said, oh, would you like to brush the horse? I'll show you how to do it and give him some carrots. Well, I didn't watch that show, so I didn't realize that was Mr. Ed until somebody pointed it out to my mom.
So you didn't have a conversation or anything with this horse?
No, he really didn't say much. You know, I don't know. He did like peanut butter though, so I guess that was his favorite thing. But I went on another soundstage where they had a dog. It was a basset hound and found out his name was Cleo, and he was part of a show called, not Hennessy, The People's Choice, which starred Jackie Cooper, who was also the director of the show and producer. And anyway, I was playing with that dog and got to know the trainer, a gentleman named Frank Yen. And, you know, anytime I had time off, I'd go over there. And finally, this guy came up to me and he said, who are you? And I said, well, my name's Stanley Livingston. Stuck my hand out and introduced myself as my mom told me to do. And mm-hmm. so I think I sort of captivated him because we had a conversation. He said, well, where are you? Are you working here? And I'm like, yeah, I'm working on stage 5. I'm on Ozzie and Harriet. So he goes, well, I'd like to meet your mom. And I'm like, am I in trouble? He said, no, don't worry about it. So I took him over to meet my mom, and I had no idea who this guy was. So I introduced him to my mom, and I could see she was kind of flummoxed that she was meeting this guy. And so afterwards, she told me, you know who that guy is? And I'm like, no. She goes, that's Jackie Cooper. He was like one of the biggest child stars ever. He was in Skippy. He was like in The Champ, a million movies when he was your age. And I was like, wow. He goes, well, he wants to do a series with you. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, I go, well, let's get out of here. So anyway, about, I guess it was 2 months later, he took one of the movies that he was in, which was a feature film called Skippy, which was the highest grossing film, I think, of 1938. Mm-hmm. He starred mm-hmm. in it. He was nominated for an Academy Award as a child actor. And he decided to remake it, but for TV and with me in the part of Skippy. So we shot that. And then that pretty much became the end of it. I guess he wanted too much money to sell it. And then he got another series, which he was directing and producing. I think he kind of lost interest. But unfortunately, I was under contract to him for like 3 years because of this thing, in case it might go. And I remember when my three sons came along and went on the interview, and somehow my parents went back to him and borrowed the reel. You know, in those days, there was no such thing as digital files, DVDs, VHS, none. They had to borrow the actual 16 millimeter print, take it to a theater, and they screened it for the producer and the production manager for My Three Sons. And the next thing I knew, I was like the first person hired on that show, except for Fred McMurray. Mm-hmm. But we asked, and they just said, well, we can't tell you who the star is, you know, till we go. So anyway, that's how I got My Three Sons, without Jackie Cooper. I owe my
career. And interestingly enough, you and Fred McMurray were the only two that remained with the series through the entire run of the series.
Yes, yes. That's how it ultimately turned out. Anyway, a couple months later, we found out they had hired William Frawley off of I Love Lucy, which made me ecstatic because I used to play hooky to watch I Love Lucy. And then they hired Tim Considine, who had worked with... Yeah, that guy in the middle there is Tim Considine.
And believe it or not, today is William Frawley's birthday. I discovered that in my research today. So happy birthday, Mr. Frawley.
Yeah, he was a great guy. He was the grandfather I never knew in real life. But Tim Considine came to the show as Mike, who was the older brother. And he and Fred had worked together in The Shaggy Dog. And I think they had done something else together at Disney. And the last person to be cast was the part of Robbie. And so they hired an actor named Bobby Diamond. And I don't know what happened. We shot a day with him. And then the next thing I knew, he wasn't there anymore. And for some reason, they let him go and put out a call for another actor. And about, I don't know, a week later, there was a new Robbie. We came in, we started shooting with him. And then we stopped again. And my memory serves me right. They didn't want him because they thought he couldn't do comedy well, so they let him go. And I remember my mom calling a friend of hers who was an agent who had a son that was he was a Mouseketeer for a while, Don Grady. Mm-hmm. They get Don down here right away. They're looking for another Robbie as yet. So he came down and nailed the part and became the official Robbie. The first episode, the pilot episode, we weren't the Douglases. I wasn't Chip Douglas. I was Chip McPherson. They changed the name to Douglas. We shot, and we finally had a pilot. And the guy who couldn't do comedy that got fired, that was Ryan O'Neill. So had they kept him, he probably wouldn't have had a career.
That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. He went on to do Peyton Place and became a huge movie star and could do comedy, by the way. So
when the series began, you began at ABC. And then, from what I read, that Tim wanted to do some directing. And there was a little friction in that department.
Yeah, that was kind of the bone of contention. It probably would have worked out that he could have directed. He did direct one episode, and I think that's where he got the bug and eventually thought he'd like to end up behind the camera. The problem for him was the way we shot. We didn't shoot one episode out. In other words, we wouldn't get a script and go, okay, we're going to shoot this beginning to end, and now we move into the next episode. And you could have had another director, or you could have had Tim back again to direct that one and that one. And he kind of made a demand to direct maybe, I don't know whether it was 5 or 10 episodes, but the way we worked was we shot in multiple scripts per day. We could shoot in, there was days when we shot 10 different shows, a bedroom scene here, a kitchen scene here from this particular episode. And then we'd move downstairs in the living room, shoot 2 episodes there from 2 different shows. So it was really impossible for the continuity to do that. You really had to have one director for the entire series that knew what was going on.
Now, was that the norm in terms of the
way? No, not the norm. That was what they came up with to figure out a way how to shoot around Fred McMurray. The idea was he would come in, he would work from 8 to 5 every single day, and he was in every single scene. So they would start shooting shows, but you had to start shooting more than one episode to do that. And then during the summer months, he would go away for 3 months. And then at the end, he would come back for another 3-4 months. And whatever scenes hadn't been shot, he would finish. Or there were scenes that we would shoot with him. And if he walked out the door, they'd say, cut. A photographer would step in, take a Polaroid, and we'd just sort of freeze. That's where we were. And sometimes a month later, we come back there and finish off the scene. Or we would shoot a scene where Fred was going to come through the door at a certain point, and they would say, cut, shoot Polaroid. And we'd pick up that scene when Fred came back at the end of summer. So that was
that confusing to you at all? At that, I mean,
what? No, because you know, even in movies and stuff like that, they're not completely shot in order.
Basically,
because of location concerns, actors' availabilities. You know, there's all kinds of reasons why they do that. Or you got a star who's making $5,000 a day, and you can shoot him out in a day. Back then, you know, you wanted to do that, so we had to learn. But you know, if you were going to go on and have a career behind the scenes, that was an excellent way to shoot, to show you really what you could do. And it's not required that you shoot everything in sequential order, but you can shoot it backwards and then put it back together in the editing room, which unfortunately did happen to me once on a music video. We were shooting, we had some Chippendale dancers in it, and they were supposed to be there so we could shoot it in order. And we got a call from the manager, and they were delayed 2 hours. I said, we can't delay 2 hours because we won't have enough time. We have to be out here by midnight. And so I said, the heck with it. You know, I'm going to shoot it backwards. We'll shoot from over here where we end up, how I blocked it out, and work our way backwards to the beginning so we wouldn't have to keep moving the equipment back and forth. You know, I just literally did it backwards and then put it back together in the editing room. So movie magic.
So after several years of being a successful show on ABC, the show moves to CBS. That's when I really became familiar with the series. Was there a shift in the way things were done that changed the dynamics when you moved over to CBS?
Not really. We moved to a new set because it was on the CBS. Back then, what did they call it? CBS on Radford?
Were you a
Desi Lou? That's where it was originally shot, which is the old RKO studios. And then we moved to Cinema Center. That's what it was called most days. And that's where CBS shot a lot of TV movies and their feature films. But they started doing actual series there. And that was the old Republic 4-star studio. So, you know, it had a real history, the studio a lot. But yeah, we had a different house here, and it was outside. And the house on My Three Sons was off the lot in the early years. It was on a street called, I think it was like Fifth Street or something, towards downtown LA. And occasionally we'd go there and we'd shoot for whatever reason. But they also had a duplicate of the same house on the soundstage, which when I think about it, it didn't really look that much like it. I don't know how, you know, if like one time you'd see this house, the next time you'd see that house, but it's the same house, what the heck. But there, yeah, there was a house that was built. In fact, funny, I was watching a film noir, I think it was Rhonda Fleming or something, about 2 years ago. I was up late and I was just watching all these old film noir. And I'm looking when they kept going into the house, and finally I had a son's house. This was like 1945 or something, but it was the same house. It was painted slightly different color, but I had my iPhone, pulled it up and looked at it. Same shrubbery, but it was a little bit smaller. But it was the house. So it had been around, and for whatever reason, that was the house they assigned to us to use for the exterior of My Three Sons in the later years, the last 5 years when we moved over to Cinema Center, which was great for me personally because we lived right by that. I literally lived like 3 miles from the studio, where when it was a Desi Lu, we lived in the San Fernando Valley Studio City then, and we'd have to get in, and to go 5 miles on the freeway, even in those days, took an hour, you know, to get to studio from Studio City. Great.
I read somewhere where you said, obviously, that Fred McMurray was a mentor to you. What were some of the life lessons that you learned from him, both professionally and personally, that you've carried through your life?
Kind of came to that conclusion later. It's not like, you know, when I was working with him, you know, oh, this guy's my mentor. I'm going to basically suck everything I can from acting time and how he handles himself. No, it just became in retrospect, looking, you know, in my memories of how he handled himself on a set. You know, it's just like almost anything in life, when it's going well, there's no friction, no problems. Mm-hmm. But, you know, occasionally something would come up. And, you know, I've been on sets when something came up and people would throw things and have tantrums and start screaming. And, you know, or the whole thing just like shuts down. People don't show up for work at 8 o'clock in the morning. They mosey on in at 10 o'clock, you know, delaying the process. But it just, you know, he had a work ethic. And I just thought the way he handled himself when there was a problem that he didn't want to let get by, you know, he was very soft-spoken, and he would talk to this assistant director or the director, and they would call the upper management, and the producer would come down, occasionally the executive producer, and then followed by about three writers who could handle the problem, and we wait around till they got it rewritten and we'd have to learn it all over. He was really a stickler for that. It's not like he came in and, you know, just whatever, and we did the scene. I mean, he was, if it didn't make sense to him, you know, he didn't want to do it. And that rarely happened, but it did happen enough times that, you know, you would do it, you know, where other people go, who writes this shit? You know, it's
like, well, over the course,
you know, they go crazy.
The show ran for 12 years on two networks, and you went through various directors through the years. Were there any particular director that you gravitated towards the most?
Yes. Three in particular. The first one, a gentleman named Peter Tewksbury, who came to My Three Sons, actually, from Father Knows Best. And he was another stickler for perfection, which was great for us, the actors. Horrible for the production manager, because it meant he was going to shoot it over and over and over again until he got it right, and which meant he was using a lot of film. And he was also involved in the editing. And I believe the first year he was also one of the producers. And I became very friendly with the guy who was the production manager. He was billed as the production manager. Really, he was the producer of our show, the nuts and bolts producer. He wasn't like an executive producer who would, you know, come in and look around and go, okay, everything's great. I'm going to go take a 4-hour lunch right now. His name was John Stevens. And he was my, if you want to say mentor, he really was my mentor. I liked the way he handled everything. And if there was problems on or off the set, he was, you know, he had to wrangle all those problems. Yeah, where was I going with that? I don't know.
The directors, you said they were.
Oh, yeah, getting back to the directors. Well, Peter Tewksbury, like I said, he was a perfectionist. And he, you know, almost every scene, especially if there was some emotion involved, that would, especially me, would take me aside and we'd rehearse it. And he would, you know, talk to me about the backstory or how I got to that point, you know, real crafty stuff. Meanwhile, I'm 8 and I'm like, you know, you find, you don't realize you're learning that stuff, even though you're sort of you think about it later and go, wow, you know, what that guy was telling me is how you get there as an actor. And in those early days, especially the first year, God knows how many crying scenes I had. And I had a cry, so it couldn't be fake. So I just thought he was the greatest. And anyway, he didn't come back for season 2. And oh, that's the reason I brought up John Stevens' name. He was telling me once, he said, I think we shot more film in the first year than we did in all the other 11 seasons that followed. That's how much film got blown off. Another guy who was great to work with, but a completely different kind of director, was Gene Reynolds. Mm-hmm. The name may be familiar. He's the guy that directed and was the producer of Lou Grant. Also, MASH. He was one of the, you know, forces behind MASH and Lou Grant. And he also was a child actor. Came along, and yeah, we had a great time. We just bonded, and literally till he passed away last year, you know, we were really close friends, and he was another mentor. And then the last guy was a real character, and in a way a mentor, but he knew everybody in Hollywood, and he did My Three Sons from the time we moved to CBS. I guess it was about 1967. And he left. He just didn't come back for the end year. Why? Because he became the producer of the Johnny Carson show.
Brady De Cordova.
Yeah, De Cordova. Yeah. That was just, he was like a role model, maybe not to be followed in certain ways. But he certainly had a unique personality, treated everybody the same. Didn't matter whether you were the president of the United States, the head of the studio, Fred McMurray, or the guy sweeping up in the corner there. He talked to everybody exactly the same.
I heard that from other people about him.
Yeah. And he just, you know, people were like in awe of him. You know, he just had a very unique personality in the way he handled and carried himself. you know, had directed a lot of movies, but also he was, you see, Burns and Allen. He was, I believe, the producer and director of that, and also the Jack Benny Show, which were his two best friends. At nighttime, when they weren't shooting, they'd all be playing cards together at Fred's house. So, and also joined who his little club was Ronald Reagan. So they were all these, you know, weird clique of guys that knew each other from the beginning of time, and you know, all played cards together. Yeah, but just Fred was amazing. I know my brother was totally impressed. He wanted to become Fred DeCordova number two. And he was doing a pretty good job of it for a while when he'd tell like a producer to go F himself or something. You know, you're just Fred DeCordova, that guy.
Now, over the course of 12 years, the show went through many incarnations. People came, people went, there were new cast members. From your own perspective, what do you think were some of the best additions to the show, and what additions to the show do you feel took away from the show?
You know, that's a hard one, because the show, you know, the whole concept of the show was that it was an all-male household, which in 1960 was kind of original. You know, divorce wasn't what it became in the late 60s and through the 70s. You know, everybody had one marriage and they moved on to the next marriage and the next one. So, you know, it was a house where there was a mother. They didn't dwell on it, but, you know, she passed away for some reason. In fact, I was watching an episode, never realized what she looked like, because I don't think I was in that scene, but there was a picture of her. And I'm like, oh, well, there's the mother. But there was no backstory on it. They just let the past be the past. And the whole series was created, you know, around this widower, with the trials and tribulations of trying to raise three sons from age 10 to about 16, 17. And to help him, a grandfather, the maternal grandfather, was brought in, which was William Frawley. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was kind of original, you know, for its day, and funny, because, you know, we didn't know how to do anything. So pots and pans would burn up and wash would get destroyed. And, you know, we were just doing the best they can. I think it really attracted a big female audience who all, you know, wanted to help us get through our trials and tribulations. Right. Not to mention everybody every week was dating a different girl. Fred McMurray would have his date, and it just kind of never worked out. So for whatever reason, and then Bill Frawley occasionally would have a date, and it'd be pretty funny. There were some scenes around that where he was self-conscious because he was bald, and he got this cream and put it all over his head and it's trying to grow a hair. And then myself, I was 10 years old, and, you know, at that age, you don't like girls. You want to punch them in the eye and stuff. And then Don Grady was kind of our teenage hunk. Mm-hmm. And then same thing with Tim. He was a little bit older, you know, almost an adult. So he got another slice of that female audience. So there was somebody there for everybody. If you're Fred McMurray's age or Bill Frawley's age or on down to me, 10 years old, you know, we all had women after us. So they went with that for about as long as they could, but then it was sort of like, well, aren't these guys growing up coming up with women? So they decide, well, Tim left the show. How they got him off the show was he got married to Meredith McRae, mm-hmm. with his girlfriend on the show, Sally. And at the first episode, I believe, of the fifth or sixth season, he disappeared into the Twilight Zone with her, never to be heard from again. And then Don Grady meets Tina Cole, and relationship blossoms there, and finally I think at the end of that year they got married. And then the following year, to keep the story going, they had triplets. And then right after that, Fred, who, you know, God knows how long since he got laid, but whatever, they found Beverly Garland for him. And so he's like a 6-year-old guy now with like a, I don't know, 40-year-old woman, and she had a daughter, Dodie. And yeah, they came on the show, and you know, some people like that. Some people didn't. They didn't like Dodie for whatever reason. I thought she was really cute. But
I did too.
The thing I read about the show, it's like, God, when they got Dodie, it jumped the shark or whatever they said. And I felt bad, you know, because she didn't cause it. She's just, you know, a young girl and, you know.
Let's go with the end.
Finally, I got married.
I'm sorry?
I said, finally, I got married. I married Polly. And I think had we lasted another 2 years, Barry would have got married. And then I think they were looking for somebody for Tramp.
Well, that experience of growing up in the consciousness of America, essentially, Were you bothered when you went out and people recognized you? Or did you enjoy the fame? What was that experience like for you?
Well, you know, I already had some of that before I even came to My Three Sons, because I always went back to public school, and it was just kind of weird because I'm just a kid, you know, and I knew people from nursery school and kindergarten, but then all of a sudden I started showing up on their TV sets, and they're like, "What's this all about? Why is this guy on TV and I'm not?" And you know, I was the guy that went to that swim school. That's probably why. But yeah, you know, got a little bit weird where I would go to school, but especially after My Three Sons started, because now you're on a show that's got 60, 70 million people a week watching it, and it's on every week. So there was no way not to be noticed. And when I would go back to public school, like I said, I was in the fifth or sixth grade by then, you know, it would be like a crowd would come around the first day. And, you know, either wanting to be your friend or, you know, wanting to pound you into submission because they were jealous. And mm-hmm. you know, all the girls are chasing you all over and trying to hold you down and kiss you. And I was like, you know, I still wasn't quite ready for that. And then junior high, it was the same thing. But that was even rougher because by that point, you know, guys are really jealous, especially if they're girlfriend like you. And, you know, it just seemed like I was constantly in fights. Same thing when I went to another junior high. My parents moved to the Valley, and I went to Milliken Junior High. But it was that first day I used to dread because I knew what was going to happen. You know, by
your parents felt that it was important. Your parents thought it was important for you to go to public school.
They thought it was important. Yeah, most kids really didn't do that. Most of the kids that were on TV shows, there was a place in Hollywood called Hollywood Professional School, and most of the children or teenagers that were on various TV shows went there. And my parents talked about that for a while, and I think I was for that because, you know, I was the guy bearing the brunt when I would go back to public school and knew what I was going to be facing for weeks at a time until it kind of, you know, cooled off because people finally got used to you, and the guys that were really your friends were your friends, and the ones who wanted to kill you were still trying to kill you. But, yeah, I wanted to do that. But, you know, I think I credit my parents. That was really a better idea. They said, no, we don't want you to do that because you're just going to be around actors. We don't want you to get a big head. And they're probably right. You don't want to get a big head. And we're going to send you to public school. And you're just going to have to deal with it. You know, deal with the kids, deal with the teachers, because that's real life. And you know what? When this is over, that's where you're going to live. You're not going to live in this other school. You know,
that brings me to my next question. I mean, as you're going through this series, is this the career choice that you felt that you would continue into adulthood? You never thought of anything else as a career vocation?
Not really. I mean, I liked artwork and I always did that, but that came about because you had to do stuff that was quiet. So I came pretty proficient at painting, you know, and all mediums, oil, watercolor, you name it, acrylic, I learned how to do that. But that, yeah, I didn't really think of that as a vocation either. I just thought of that as something to, you know, pass the time. Of course, when I got to be, I guess, about 13 and the Beatles hit, like I put my paintbrush here. So I need a guitar. And so like every other guy in America, you know, went out and bought a guitar. I think my first guitar though was from a pawn shop. I didn't know any better. And I bought a classical guitar whose neck was about that wide. It was four strings about that high off the fret. So I had a lot of bloody fingers in the beginning, but learned how to play on it. And then I finally went and bought a Fender Mustang.
Do you still play?
No, I don't. My brother does. In fact, I gave my guitars to Barry finally. No, what happened for me really was I guess when I was about 17, I just thought, you know what? I want to do this, but I don't know if I want to be an actor. And I started talking to the crew guys about the cameras, and film emulsions, and lenses, and parallax, and then the editors about why they were cutting it. So I really learned, all the back stuff, like how to budget shows, literally how to do the scheduling. You see his strips to schedule everything at the strip board back then. So I learned everything behind it. And when I was 18, I formed a production company with a guy that I met at LACC, Los Angeles City College. I took some broadcasting classes there, a cinematography class, and I was hooked on that, and I thought, well, I think this is the way I want to go. I'll do the acting stuff as long as stuff keeps coming up. But I was really intrigued with it, and then I just thought I'd like to be more in control of my career. I really had a hard time with agents where it's like, I'm ready to go on an interview, and I used to sit there and go like this to the phone, you know, willing it to ring, and that I would have an interview and go meet some casting guy. And sometimes that worked. Most of the time it didn't, but it just felt out of control to me that you're waiting on other people. And I've just always been the sort of person that there's something to do, I'm the guy to pick it up and let's get going right now. Right now, I don't want to wait. So unfortunately, I had that streak in me. And, you know, so I, with the production company, started doing, you know, commercials, industrials, whatever we could get to shoot and edit. And I figured, you know, you learn how to do that stuff. And then, you know, over the decades, you watch it all change from film to well, actually there was linear editing originally, CMX machines, and then eventually non-linear machines, and then finally videotape becoming this big deal, especially when it became digital, that you're going, wow, this could replace film and would be a lot less expensive. They can just get the cameras better, and you know, we're there. You know, it's weird.
Now, were agents trying to pigeonhole you at that time also?
Yeah, that was my other big beef. I must have played a high school student to the time I was about 24, 25. I mean, granted, I looked young. I always wished I was Richard Dreyfuss. He looked like he was 50 when he was 18. Yeah, but for a career, it's better. It's better. You look like an adult. I always thought till I was 30, I would get stopped by police in Hollywood wanting to see my driver's license. And see if I was old enough to drive, which that's kind of a drag. I'm going, well, I'm going to be playing, you know, a teenager my entire life. I've been in 12th grade now for about 12 years, so it's pretty weird. Yeah.
Now, when, where, and how did you find out that the show would not be returning, and what was that experience like for you emotionally?
Well, that was an annual thing, really. We never knew the show was coming back. From the first season on, when we finished shooting, we said goodbye to everybody like it wasn't coming back. And literally until 2 weeks before they had a start date, we didn't know we were coming back. We usually get a telegram from William Paley at CBS going, welcome back to another season of My Three Sons. You know, you guys are going to start shooting in 2 weeks and we wish you another successful season. Well, that went on for 12 seasons. And then right about the time we should have been receiving that telegram, it's like, huh, there's no telegram. Well, the decision had been made that it wasn't coming back. Fred didn't. I think he didn't want to do it anymore was one of the reasons. But the other was the show was actually doing really well in the ratings, but the FCC had come down with a mandate that year, the year prior to would have been our 13th season, that the networks could not own and exhibit a show. It was considered antitrust. It was like in the old days with film.
Yes.
You know, you couldn't make it and show it. You were one or the other. And, you know, we were a 12-year-old show. And the only thing you could possibly do with that would be sell it back to an outside producer who would then make the show again. And, you know, it was a 12-year-old show. So you go, you know, it's like a ball tire at that point. You don't want to buy that tire. You want one with some tread on it. And,
I've got a couple of questions over here that I want to respond to, because a lot of people are watching and they're going to drive me crazy if they're going to come after me. But how did the dynamics change when your brother came onto the show?
It was great, but Barry was kind of subtly slipped in there. I don't know how many people noticed this, but before he was a son, he was on there as a friend. And how that came about was we did the very last show I did of Ozzie and Harriet. Ozzy asked my brother to come on the show and be my little brother in that episode. And he ate a big dish of ice cream. And I said goodbye to the Nelsons because I couldn't come back to their show once My Three Sons started. And, you know, they wished me well and I left. But they kept Barry on the show and he replaced me. He became the proverbial neighborhood kid. So anytime they needed a kid, it was Barry. And then on My Three Sons, about the third year, they had a guy that was playing my friend, but, you know, they'd seen Barry in so much stuff. And by then he did The Errand Boy with Jerry Lewis and some big movies. They thought, well, why don't we get this kid? Plus, he keeps coming over to visit Stan. They knew Tim was leaving, and the show was called My Three Sons. So we needed a third son in a hurry. And Barry had proven himself, even on My Three Sons, he'd done about four or five episodes on there. In fact, one episode they specifically wrote for him where it was when the 007 movies were out. Mm-hmm. And he was like spying. He was spying on us or whatever it was. It was really cute. And he had a hat and a trench coat and all that stuff. But yeah, so he came on. So for me, you know, I growing up in the industry, and especially the first 3 years of my third son, you're around adults all day. You know, it's me and 50 people that are 30, 40, 50, 100, whatever these old guys were. And you know, it was a great environment to be in. But unless there was a child actor working on the show, and a lot did, like Jay North or Jerry, Jerry Mather, Tony Dow. You know, I'd have no friends on the set. So when Barry became a permanent son, I finally had somebody in the classroom for the 3 hours we went to school per day. We shared a dressing room. We shared a ride to work. We shared a bedroom at home, so we were sort of used to each other.
And you know, our mutual friend Christopher Reardon says hello.
Tell him hi.
Yes, he said when he did My Three Sons, he only got to work with Don Grady, who, by the way, was truly wonderful. However, Stan and his brother and I often got to do the Hollywood autograph show together. I have to say I have the utmost respect for the Livingston brothers, and he was looking forward to this interview. These autograph shows, do you enjoy doing them?
Yeah. You know, first I was like, well, what are they? I thought they were with Western stars. This goes back to about 1990. And how I got involved was Paul Peterson called me. He said, do you want to do an autograph show? And I said, well, I didn't do that many Westerns. The only one I ever did was How the West Was Won. And he said, no, they're past that. They're into classic TV people now. And maybe you and your brother or you would like to do it. So I tried it, and you know, I thought it was kind of interesting, you know, to have fans come up to you and be that accessible to them. And you know, they all ask the same questions, so you have to be pretty tolerant too. There's some certain people that get aggravated after a while. You know, I can take just about anything when you've spent your whole life waiting to work on a sound. That's like the old joke that actors say, you know, it's the acting we do for free, we get paid to wait. It's basically how it works out for your paycheck. So, yeah, you know, it's nice. And what I saw that I didn't realize was, you know, when I started doing it, I guess I was about 40 maybe, 50. But there were a lot of older actors, and it seemed to be a way with dignity for them, you know, to make some money if they weren't working as much. So I don't know whether the promoter was of that mind, but I just thought it was nice for him to provide venue for them to come there and to be honored and to be liked. And, you know, people are really nice to you at the shows and admired your work or liked your work or your characters and all that. And then on top of it, you're making money. And, you know, some people came in there who were stars on big TV shows like Don Knotts or Ernest Borgnine. Mm-hmm. You know, they walk away with $20,000, $30,000 in $20 bills for a weekend. Hey, you know, who wouldn't want to do that?
No, of course.
I did okay. Did better in the beginning. But by the end, I said, gee, I think I've signed an autograph for everybody on earth by now. So it just comes to the point of diminishing returns. But the other thing that I liked about it was I saw people that I hadn't seen in years. So it's kind of like going to your high school reunion. Mm-hmm. And you see people, they either worked on your show or you worked on their show or you were friends with on or off screen and just lost touch. So I really got a kick out of that.
And someone's asking, will you be writing your memoirs? And also, while we're at that, what is your fondest memory of My Three Sons?
Well, probably William Frawley. You know, if I had a pick a character, I mean, my brother and I are obviously really close and we see each other all the time. But if somebody's not here anymore, Bill was just, you know, I liked him when I saw him on the I Love Lucy show. I just liked his cranky character. And I remember Barry and I, we'd always go, let's fake it today. We'll pretend to be sick. And, you know, so we'd be in bed till 9 o'clock when I Love Lucy. And then we'd kind of come out to the couch with our blanket, pretend to be sick while we were watching I Love Lucy, and then have a miraculous recovery about 9:30. Then our parents would be mad. But he just was charming to me. And when I found out he was going to be on the show, I didn't know if he'd like me or not, because you know, sometimes guys like that, they're like W.C. Fields. They hate kids. They hate animals. And for whatever reason, he warmed up to me. And a lot of my
Was he good around kids?
What's that?
Did he like being around kids?
I don't know. He didn't have any. And I never really saw him associate with, you know, any other kids. But for whatever reason, he took a shine to me. And, you know, he had me doing all kinds of corruptible things. We'd go to lunch and he'd order a drink and he'd order me one. You know,
and I'm like, and how old were you at the time?
11, 12 maybe.
Good for him.
But yeah, what happened was he was also, you know, starting to drink again, was a little bit inebriated. We used to eat lunch at this place every day called Nicodels on Melrose Avenue. It's kind of gone now, got assimilated by the wall of Paramount. But we'd go in there and he would have a drink or two. And sometimes he wouldn't want to get up and leave after the hour was up for lunch. And people come in there and try and get him up. And you know, Bill's like, go after yourself kind of thing. So it sort of became my job. Well, I got nudged by my guardian. She'd go like that, show me the watch. And then I could get Bill up. He would do whatever I would say. So I go, come on, Bill, we got to get back to work. Okay, good. You know, he would get immediately up and follow me back. So that was kind of the relationship. When I turned 13, though, that was my favorite story about Bill. I was into surfing by then. And I tell him all about it. And, you know, he seemed to enjoy, you know, my stories. And for my 13th birthday, I remember we went to lunch in Nicodels. And when I came back, I went up to my dressing room, opened the door, and there was a 9-foot-long Dewey Weber surfboard in there.
Wow.
From Uncle Bill, which, if you think about that, it kind of brings a tear to my eye.
No, that's
because, you know, he could have said, here's $20. That would be a lot easier to do. But it's sort of like, how did you get that surfboard? Because you don't drive. And where did it come from? And, but what it meant to me was he was listening to me and knew what I was interested in and somehow either wrote it down or told somebody else and had them go get it. Because like I said, he didn't drive. But just the fact that he was into what I was into, you know, really meant something, you know, to me. And it just such a great guy. I mean,
well, there's the answer to the question. He liked kids. I mean, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. He took a shine. And then when Barry came on the show, you know, he really liked Barry, too. We were, you know, maybe by that point he wished he had kids or had, I mean, we really would have been like grandkids to him more than kids, but,
now, are there any books on my three sons? And if so, are there any books that you recommend?
Well, there's not really one on my three sons. There was a guy, who was working on a My Three Sons book, but it was really, God, I have a copy of it. And I don't know what to do about it. I tried to help this guy. He lived in Australia, though. And before I could get in contact with him, he wrote the most phenomenal book and study of My Three Sons. It's My Three Sons on the molecular level, let me tell you. His name was Jeff Brown, G-E-O-F-F Brown. And, you know, I was in contact with him. He came to the United States a couple times, and we went out to lunch and dinner and invited him to a party and you know, introduced him to some of the people I knew in show business. But unfortunately, he passed away last year. So
I'm sorry.
Just sitting there, and I wish I could get a publisher. I don't know whether his family would want that or not. I think it was his niece contacted me, wanted to know if I had any videotape of him or any kind of pictures they didn't have. But yeah, the guy was just the nicest guy, and boy.
Now, your first acting gig or job after My Three Sons was a movie called Private Parts. Was that a movie that you chose, or was this something that an agent brought to you?
I was dying to work, to be honest. I went out on some other, turned a couple movies down. One of them was a movie called Teacher's Pet, and I got it. And it was sort of sorted too, in a way. It's about a high school student having an affair with his teacher.
This wasn't the Doris Day Clark Gable film.
No, I forgot the woman's name. She was kind of a sexy blonde at that time, and they got her. And anyway, I was going to be paired up. But then this other movie came about with a guy named Lou Jacoby that I just liked his acting, wanted to work with him. And I bowed out of that movie. I let it go. And in fact, I said, if I could get you somebody like me, would you let me out of the contract? And so they said, well, it depends who it is. So I said, well, I know the guy that was on Dennis the Menace. So if you're into me, you'd probably be into him. And he's a pretty good actor. And so anyway, the deal got made and he ended up with that part. And I was supposed to do this movie called The Pig Man with Lou Jacoby. And plus it was going to be shot in Baltimore, which is where my parents, you know, ultimately moved out here from. So I thought that was perfect. And then the financing fell through and I lost both films. And then there was another movie. I forgot what happened. Oh, yeah, it was a movie about a kid who's retarded. And anyway, well, it got nixed almost right from the beginning. I went out for the audition, and just a couple of people went. But I got to the place, and I saw two doors with the same number. And I thought, well, which door is it? You know, so I just picked the door and opened it. And I started to walk in. I see somebody laying on the floor, like kicking and rolling. And I like pulled the door shut. And I'm like, what the hell was that? So I went in the other door, and the lady there goes, oh, yeah, are you? Yeah. She said, you're standing. I'm like, yeah. She goes, here's the sides. So I started looking through here. Well, it's like a retarded kid who's not older than mentally than a four-year-old or something. Mm-hmm. And my brain's going, that must have been the guy on the floor. Mm-hmm. So being the actor I am, I did the best I could with the material, went in. And so I'm talking to the producers. And, you know, sometimes there's just a couple guys there. There's like about 10 people. And all I'm thinking in my head is, wait a minute, I'm going to have to act like a baby, because that was the name of the movie. Mm-hmm. And roll around on the floor like, you know, I'm 2 years old in a diaper. And I go, man, this is like so humiliating. But I went for it, did the audition. And in fact, I think I didn't even say goodbye to anybody. I just got up and walked out the door. Got in a car crash about a block away. Came home, flopped on the couch, and my wife was like, what's wrong? And I go, you wouldn't believe what I just did. I don't believe what I just did. And the worst part of it, there was a video camera in there. So somewhere
out there, there's a video.
That video exists. So, but yeah, and then Private Parts came along. That was actually a film that Roger Corman's brother, Gene Corman, who's also a producer, the guy that did The Big Red One with Lee Marvin, Mark Hamill, a bunch of guys that were popular out of that era. And so I met the director, Paul Bartel, and he was kind of a kooky guy, but I really liked him, like a wannabe Alfred Hitchcock kind of guy. And anyway, we hit it off, and next thing I knew, I got hired to be in Private. Well, when I did, it was called Vital Parts. And I don't know which one's worse. And, what does this title mean? And this title isn't too good. But anyway, unfortunately, they made this movie, and it was kind of a very Hitchcockian film. You know, it had a murder in it and kind of a whodunit. And it was stylishly shot. In fact, I think the guy was the DP. I forget his name, but he went on to become a director. And Judith Crist gave it a rave review. And I think MGM just, they had a problem with it. They printed the prints. They changed the title from Vital Parts to Private Parts. And I don't know whether what your age is, but around 1974, 75, there used to be porno in theaters. You know, not like where you'd walk and get a VHS copy and take it home, mm-hmm. but actually movies showing movies of porno. And what the newspapers decided to do, because it was a big furor that the porno films were mixed in with real movies and people were going to accidentally, I don't know if that was the truth or not, but they would end up seeing a porno film because they thought it was real. So what they did in the newspapers, they would put all the porno films that were playing in town on one page, and it was grayed out. It wasn't like the dark black ink. Mm-hmm. And when they saw the name Private Parts, they wouldn't print the title in black ink on the regular page. They thought it was porno, and it ended up. And anyway, MGM, who was the distributor, pulled it, and it sat in a vault till Turner bought the library. And they went, wow, this film's really good. And they started showing it and finally got a cult audience. And Paul by then had done some other films and had quite a following. And yeah, occasionally I see it even on, you know, cable TV. It'll
Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah. Turner Classics. Yeah, it's a good movie. And with just an unfortunate choice of the title, unless you're, what's his name? Howard, he did a film called, The Disc Jockey, The Shock Jock.
Howard Stern.
Yeah, Howard Stern. He did a movie called Private Parts. Mm-hmm. And so when I would say it, I'd say, I didn't see you in that. I go, well, I wasn't in that. There's another one from 1974, 75 made by Paul Bartel. And then I had to tell the whole story. I go, if you rent it and see it, it's actually better than you would think it would be with the name of Private Parts. Had they named it something else, it might have got out there.
It would have known.
It has the most unbelievable review from Judith Crist, who was pretty hard on everything.
Yes, so that's true.
If you liked it, that says something. But unfortunately,
I can't believe it, but we are at the end of our show. I enjoyed this with you today, so thank you so much. But I do want to ask you before we do wrap everything up, we've enjoyed looking back, but what's next for you?
Hopefully getting rid of pandemic. I had a couple projects in the pipeline last year. I had a TV pilot I was supposed to direct, and I bowed out of it. We had a start date. We had the money, and we bumped it for 2 months. I said, I think we should bump it, see where this thing's going. And then I tried to read as much I could about how the Guild was reacting to COVID. And, you know, they by then had come down with some guidelines. And I go, well, these are going to be like impossible, you know, for us to do. But even worse, this about this time, 2-3 months later, it was exploding, which is what I told my two partners. I go, they're saying it's going to, you know, not be 2 or 3 people a day. It's going to be 1,000 people a day. And that's what it was. And I said, if we shoot this thing, we're doing exactly what they're saying not to do. We're bringing 30, 40 people together, going to lock them in a set, you know, 16 hours a day for 2 or 3 days. You know, that's what they're telling you not to do. So they wanted to push ahead. And I'm like, I don't want it. Legal liability here. I checked. Can't get COVID insurance. I'm out. So that went. And right now I've got another TV pilot I'm working on. And hopefully as soon as I'm not going anywhere to this thing.
Neither am I.
No, I do not want to get the money and have to.
But I will say this, you know, whenever you have anything you want to talk about, you've got a platform right here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you. We'll
have to do this again. And who knows, maybe there'll be a part two to my life.
There definitely is a part two to your life.
Better hurry up, though. I'm getting old, man.
Oh, please. You know, I'm right behind you.
Yeah, you're spring chicken compared to me.
Well, I want to thank everybody for being here today. Thank you, Stanley. If you enjoyed today's show, and I hope you did, whatever platform you're watching this on, whether it be YouTube or Facebook or any of the podcast platforms, please leave a comment wherever you are. That helps to boost this show in other markets. Or you can go to my website, richardskipper.com. Put your thoughts about the show there. I want to let everyone know, if you're around tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, I'm sitting down with Tamara Jenkins. Do you know Tamara?
I don't know. I think
director.
A friend of mine, Elaine, referred me to you. I think it was Elaine Ballas.
Elaine Ballas?
Yeah.
We both love. I love her dearly.
She's an old friend. So,
and thank you, Elaine, for that. I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Go to your Facebook friends list, and the sixth name that pops up, give that person a phone call. Not a text, not an email, not a private message. Pick up the phone and let them know what they mean to you. As my dear friend David Friedman says, we're all in this together, but we're not in the same boat. You never know what someone else is going through at this time. Reach out. And Stanley, I want to give you the final word. Anything that you want to expound upon that we talked about today, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or just any message that you want to put out to anyone who's watching right now. And again, thank you for all you've given.
Well, for fans, you know, I want to thank them for being fans all these years. You know, we did the pilot in 59, went on the air in 1960, and who knew 60 years later, going on 61 years, that the show would still be on. And that wouldn't happen without the fan base. And for people that are thinking they're coming into show business, you know, you got to have a dream, you got to do it. My suggestion also is to learn the business side of the business, not just the acting, because you need both. And you just have to persevere. You can't take no for an answer. And unfortunately, you'll hear a lot of no's. So if you're easily offended by this word, don't do it. But just push right through it. That's all you can do. Everybody will tell you you shouldn't do it. But if it's in your heart to do it, do it.
Amen. Thank you, Stanley. Have a great evening. Bye.
Thank you. Bye now.